This is Chris Bacon, composer for Bates Motel, and you're listening to Good Evening.
To Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock podcast. I'm your host for today, Brandon Shamutella, and good news, everyone! We've got everybody here today. Joining us from across the pond is our long-lost brother from another murder, Chris Haig.
Yes, I've been sailing in that lifeboat all the way across. I'm your foreign correspondent. Can you tell that I'm tired and trying to shoehorn as many Hitchcock things in as much as possible?
It's wonderful. It's wonderful. Excellent. We're glad to have you. The last two episodes Tom and I did together, so we're very excited to have you here. We're very excited that we're able to all meet at this time.
I know.
It's perfect time.
Well, I've had some changes in my work life that have made it difficult for the team to get together at the same time. So, yeah, this is a rare opportunity that we're all in the show at the same time. Yeah. This is good.
It's all Tom's fault.
It's all my fault.
Also, in Canada. Joining us, Tom Caldwell, the ever-present, wonderful, amazing man who's here today, was yesterday in Saskatoon. Welcome home.
Yeah, no, it's good. We finally got some summer weather happening in Regina, and so I have maybe next time I'll sit up on the back deck and you'll be able to hear birds chirping in the background as we record.
Yes, we can do that. Excellent. Well, we've got a little bit of housekeeping to go over first, and this is the first episode we've recorded. Now, you guys will have heard it twice already, but this is the first time we've recorded since we got it. We got ourselves a brand new theme song. What do you guys think of it?
It's cool.
I love it. It's so good.
It's great. My friend Jason Cullimore, who's from here in Regina, he's an award-winning Canadian composer. We went for lunch one day, and I asked him if he would compose something for us, and he graciously went above and beyond the call of duty and created us one of the coolest theme songs ever.
Yeah.
So I hope you guys like it. Definitely, please go check him out. He's on SoundCloud. He's on Instagram. He's got his own website, jasoncullimore.com. And Cullimore is Cullimore. And Tom and I know him because he's from our board gaming community here in Regina. So he's a cool dude. I like him a lot, and we are ever grateful. So be sure to check out his work. He's got albums available in iTunes, and so check him out. He's done some great
good things come from board gaming.
Chris, you got to play some board games with us.
Do you know, if we manage to set it up online and just be like, okay, how the hell are we going to do this? I'm just going to have to do it play by play, like those people who play chess halfway around the world from each other.
That's too complicated. Oh. We should set up a game of cross ocean snakes and ladders.
Yeah, right. Battleship. Battleship. The obvious one.
Yeah, that's there you awesome. Go, Tom.
Okay, fair enough. All right.
Cool. And yes, we also have, courtesy of Norman Lau from the Fandom Podcast Network, a wonderful new show art. We've also got, so check that in your feeds. We've got new show art, a new look to our design, our new look to our show, because we're just after a year. I mean, we're recording this, I think it was about 2 weeks ago and a year ago. That sounded weird. A year and 2 weeks ago that we released our first three episodes. Oh, so, you know, time for some spring cleaning and...
And because it's episode 18, it's like we're now adults. So it's time for a whole new look. It's time
Speak
for a
for yourself.
And before we go into the main episode, before we go into our discussion today on our feature, Murder, we have got some wonderful feedback from our Facebook page. Tom, would you be so kind as to read Alan's comments?
Yeah, opening up the viewer mail, this is from Alan McDonald, who lives in Ohio, and he comments, Brandon, Alan says how he got caught up in our last four episodes of our podcast over the last few days. He wants to tell us, well done. It's rare to find people today willing to take themselves out of our culture and try and view things through the culture in which it was created. It was one of the very first things that Alan learned in his history studies. If you cannot picture yourself in the time period you were studying contextually, you will never understand anything but the dates and objective facts. So very good comment there from Alan. We appreciate the feedback. I think we do try as much as we can, especially when we're dealing with these really old films, mm-hmm. to not just look at them compared to what we're used to in consuming media of the modern day, but to try and look at them from the point of view of a person of that era and what else was going on culturally in the entertainment world at that time.
Mm-hmm. I think he must be referring mostly to our latest episode that's been released in our feed, which was episode 16 on An Elastic Affair and L Street Calling. Because, yeah, in that, you know, they had blackface representation on screen. And while we understand that that's not acceptable anymore, it was a part of that time. And we need to look at it objectively as what happened then. Whether it was right or wrong in the past, it's something that happened and we need to learn from it. And burying it prevents people from learning.
Right.
Yeah.
Is my point of view. That's what I think. So, excellent. Thanks, Alan. We really appreciate the feedback, and we're glad you're enjoying the show. And thanks for catching up on the show. We're glad you're listening along. Excellent. Well, let's jump right into our discussion on the movie Murder. And I'll start us off with our behind the scenes information, and then Tom's going to go into our summary of the film. Now, Murder was released in July 31st, 1930, and it's a drama film that was co-written and directed by Alfred Hitchcock, starring Herbert Marshall, Noah Baring, and Edward Chapman. It was written for the screen by Hitchcock and his wife, Alma Revel, and Walter C. Mycroft. It's based on a novel and a play called Enter Sir John by Clements Dane and Helen Simpson. The movie was 98 minutes long. Enter Sir John was the first of three detective novels written by Helen Simpson and Clements Dane. Now, Clements Dane was actually the pseudonym of Winifred Ashton. It was published in 1928, and then the two collaborated on Author Unknown and the follow-up to the first book, Re-Enter Sir John. The film was made by British International Pictures and was originally to be released under the same name as the novel, but it was changed to Murder during shooting. A number of changes were made from the book, including altering the names of the two principal characters. The portrayal of the character Sir John Mernier was loosely based on that of the actor Gerald Du Maurier, who was a friend of Hitchcock. And Hitchcock later adapted three novels written by Du Maurier's daughter, Daphne. And those three were Jamaica Inn, Rebecca, and The Birds. The film's set design were done by art director John Mead. And one really interesting behind-the-scenes piece of information for the filming of this is all of the audio was filmed live on set. So it must have been a limitation of the medium at the time that they recorded everything all at once. So for the filming of this, an orchestra actually played music live on the set during the radio scene when the guy's shaving. Okay, so Hitchcock described the filming of this scene to Francois Truffaut in the book-length interview, Hitchcock-Truffaut. He says, in the early days of sound film, there was no way to post-dub sound. So Hitchcock had Herbert Marshall's voice recorded on a phonograph record, which was played back during the filming of the scene, while the orchestra played the background music live, which was substituting for the radio in Sir John's bathroom. Now that's pretty fascinating.
That's a lot of work.
Yeah.
To go like, through all that. But definitely. It worked well.
Definitely going above and beyond the call of duty to get a interesting performance there, to get a lifelike performance. So Herbert Marshall played Sir John Mernier. He was an English stage, screen, and radio actor who, in spite of losing a leg during the First World War, starred in many popular and well-regarded Hollywood films of the 30s and 40s. He had a successful career in the United Kingdom and North America. He became an in-demand Hollywood leading man, frequently appearing in romantic melodramas and occasional comedies. In his later years, he turned to character acting. Now, he's the son of actors, but Marshall is best remembered for his roles in Ernst Lubitsch's Trouble in Paradise, Hitchcock's Murder and Foreign Correspondent, William Wyler's The Letter and The Little Foxes, Albert Lewin's The Moon and Sixpence, Edmund Golding's The Razor's Edge, and what I know him best from, Kurt Newman's The Fly from 1958. He appeared on screen with many of the most prominent leading ladies of Hollywood's golden age, including Greta Garbo, Marlena Dietrich, and Betty Davis. From 1944 to 1952, Marshall starred in his own radio series called The Man Called X. Often praised for the quality of his voice, he made numerous radio guest appearances and hosted several shows. He performed on television as well. The actor, known for his charm, married 5 times and periodically appeared in gossip columns because of his sometimes turbulent private life. During the Second World War, he worked on the rehabilitation of injured troops, especially aiding amputees like himself. And he received his star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame in 1960. We will see him one more time in a Hitchcock film, Foreign Correspondent. Nora Baring was born Nora Minnie Baker, and she was an English stage and film actress most famous on screen for playing Diana Baring in Murder. She's also known for playing the female lead in Anthony Asquith's silent thriller A Cottage on Dartmoor from 1929. She studied art prior to becoming an actress, and this is her only Hitchcock appearance. Phyllis Constam was an English actress born in London. She appeared in 11 films between 1928 and 1964, including 4 by Hitchcock. She married the tennis star Bunny Austin in 1931, whom she met on a cruise liner while traveling to the U.S. to appear in stage productions of Frank Vosper's Murder on the Second Floor, opposite her close friend Laurence Olivier. Together, Austin and Constam were one of the celebrity couples of this age. Austin played tennis with Charlie Chaplin, was friend of Daphne du Maurier, and met both Queen Mary and President Franklin D. Roosevelt. In her later years, she joined her husband with the involvement in the Oxford Group, performing in several films and theatrical productions around the world to benefit the cause. And she died in Somerset from a heart attack on the 20th of August, 1976, which was her husband's 70th birthday. We saw her before in Champagne and Blackmail, and we will see her again in The Skin Game. Now, the last actor we'll talk about is Edward Chapman. He was an English actor who starred in many films and television programs, but is chiefly remembered as Mr. Wilfred Grimsdale, the officious superior and comic foil to Norman Wisdom's character of Pitkin in many of his films from the 50s and 60s. Chapman was born in Harrogate, West Riding of Yorkshire, England. On leaving school, he became a bank clerk, but later began his stage career with Ben Greet's company in June of 24 at the Repertory Theatre, Nottingham, playing Gecko in George du Maurier's Trilby. He made his first London stage appearance at the Court Theatre in August of 1925, playing the Reverend Septimus Tudor in The Farmer's Wife. Among dozens of stage roles that followed, he played Bonaparte to Margaret Rawlings' Josephine in Napoleon at the Embassy Theatre in September of 1934. In 1928, he attracted the attention of Alfred Hitchcock, who gave him the role of the Paycock in the 1930 film Juno and the Paycock. In the same year, he also made appearance in Cast. He had a role in The Citadel in 1938 and appeared alongside George Formby in the Ealing Studios comedy Turned Out Nice Again in 1941. We will see him again in The Skin Game. Now, Hitchcock's cameo appearance happens, I think it's about an hour into the film, after the three people who are investigating the crime come out of the house and they're kind of standing there on the street. Hitchcock just kind of walks past. And Tom, you noticed an interesting little blooper in this scene, didn't you?
Yeah, there's an actual stage microphone, like a film production microphone on the corner of the frame, which is, you know, a continuity thing or a visual blooper. It doesn't really detract from the film. I guess both of you mentioned that you hadn't even spotted that.
Yeah.
And I don't think I would have seen it. I found out about Hitch's cameo through some reading on the internet, and then I went and found that scene to figure out where the cameo was. But I don't think I would have noticed the microphone if I hadn't been reading about it.
I noticed the microphone while I was watching. I had to pause it and rewind it. I'm like, that wasn't there in the last shot of that window there. I thought, was it a street lamp or something? And I'm like, no, it's going to be a mic. So.
And there was another little blooper that I saw where the three of them are sitting in the office having the fancy lunch served by the butler. And the camera pulls wide and there's obviously a a crew member sitting on a chair. You can kind of see his elbow in the corner of the frame. But, you know, these things happen. Not a big deal. You're not necessarily even going to notice them unless you're really bored and looking around.
My daughter and I were watching an episode from the 1980s Twilight Zone the other night. It was an episode called Dead Woman's Shoes. And we noticed twice, there was one scene where the camera was panning along down low. And you see a reflection in a mirror. You can see the cameraman with his microphone, like clearly, like from his mouth to his ear. And then later they're in a bathroom scene and you can see the microphone dangling from the top of the scene. So we noticed two in that episode. I showed up to Aubrey and Aubrey's like, oh my goodness. Anywho, the last
That's harmless stuff though. It doesn't really affect your enjoyment of the film very much.
The last thing we got to talk about is the fact that Hitchcock directed this movie twice. And you may say, what are you talking about? Well, the interesting thing is that for several years, British International Pictures had been partnering with European studios to create bilingual productions using a different cast. The foreign language version of the film would be shot at the same time as the English version. Studio head John Maxwell selected Enter Sir John to be such a production, and Hitchcock traveled to the Sud Film Studio in Berlin to discuss a German version of the film, which was eventually released in 1931 as Mary. So its release date was March 2nd of 1931, and it was shot with German actors, but was only 78 minutes long. And the actors that were in it were Alfred Abel as Sir John Menier, Olga, I'm going to try and say this, Chichawa? T-S-C-H-E-C-H-O-W-A. I hope I'm saying that right. Chichawa as Mary Baring, Paul Graetz as Bobby Brown, and Lott Stein as B.B. Brown. So their character names were even different in that film. And we actually got our hands on a copy of Mary, and I watched most of it. I watched an hour of the hour and 18, and I got to tell you guys, the version we had no subtitles, and it's in German. It is extremely challenging to watch a movie in another language and not have subtitles. But it sure did look good.
Well, and is it much different than watching a silent film? But I guess in a silent film, you're not battling these German words coming at you.
Yes.
I watched it. I watched the German version long enough to just get a sense of, to get a sense of how they did it and to realize that you can tell that they were shooting them at parallel times. They were using the same camera shots, the same sets, the same locations. And yeah, Hitchcock talks about how Murder was his first experience with a bilingual picture. They made the German and English versions simultaneously. He says that many touches that were quite funny in the English version were not at all amusing in the German one. So there was some lost in translation happening there. And that would be a challenge. You can't necessarily take an English language script and automatically just translate it to another language and have it work, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, as my Star Trek friends that are listening know, you haven't read Shakespeare until you've read him in the original Klingon.
Star Trek joke.
Yes. Well, Tom, do you want to give us a summary of the film and tell us a quick plot line of what happened for those that...
Yeah, a very good summary here that I found courtesy of the Internet Movie Database. Actress Edna Druce is found dead, and fellow thespian Diana Baring can't explain why she's holding the murder weapon. Diana seems destined for conviction and the death penalty, but juror, Sir John Menier, thinks that she is innocent. An actor himself, Sir John collects clues and revisits the crime scene in an attempt to clear Diana, but his noble efforts might finger another performer with ties to Edna and Diana's touring company. So it's a whodunit, but the who changes. Who is who? Like Hitchcock talks about how he didn't really like whodunits because they're like a jigsaw puzzle. There's no emotion. You're just waiting around to find out who committed the murder. I don't think this was really his style, but again, it was one of his earlier films and really one of the first fully produced sound films that he did.
Mm-hmm. I want to read a paragraph here from The Art of Alfred Hitchcock, 50 Years of His Motion Pictures by Donald Spotto, which is one of my go-to pieces for behind-the-scenes information. He says, Murder becomes Hitchcock's first serious, protracted attempt to blur the distinction between playing and really doing, thereby forcing a reassessment not only of the truth that is contained in what is false, that is art, but also the false nature of what is thought to be true, that is life. That this is mainstream Hitchcock is demonstrated by the frequency of its reoccurrence. So that's one of the... There's several themes in this movie that have come back. You know, the wrong man, in this case, the wrong woman, right? You know, characters not really appearing who they are. You know, we got some interesting stuff here with, like, with that cross-dressing person, right, who ends up actually being the killer in the end, right?
Spoiler! Spoiler!
For those that haven't seen. But I'm sure we'll get to that as we go along. But so there are some reoccurring themes in here of, like, reality versus life, stage productions, the wrong man, the innocent man, the innocent woman. Chris, what did you think of the film?
I enjoyed it. I think, I mean, because I've seen other ones like this and kind of you touch on the themes of, you know, the wrongly accused innocent and kind of all that sort of thing, which Hitchcock has a sort of fascination with, and that he will revisit, you know, in stuff like Young and Innocent or in Frenzy or in North by Northwest. I know I accidentally put a bit of thing in then. Clearly the tea I'm drinking is bourbon.
Tell us about your podcast.
Yeah. No, I'm saving it for the end. But no, I did really enjoy it. I think, unfortunately, it's a bit of a trend where, you know, I'm really enjoying most of the talkies. I wasn't a big fan of Juno and the Paycock, but this is very interesting. It reminds me a lot of a film he does in the 50s called Stage Fright.
Mm-hmm.
With Marlene Dietrich, and it's similar. It's about a murder in the theatrical world and all that sort of thing. I enjoyed it. I mean, there were some parts of it that were... I think the other thing that really threw me, because the bit... Okay, again, spoilers, but the big twist at the end is that, you know, a certain member of the performing troupe has done it, fine, but it's all to protect a secret, and that secret ends up being that this person is secretly biracial, or as they used to call it back then, half caste, which I don't know if that's a thing in North America, if that's like a slur there, but in the UK...
I have never heard that term before.
So half...
that's brand new to me.
So half caste is, I guess now, a British slur that was used to kind of defame someone who came from kind of mixed race heritage, or, you know, like mixed race parents, that sort of thing. And it turns out the killer is white passing, and that's the big thing. And I just remember thinking, I was like, oh, it speaks a lot of the racial politics of the time.
Right.
That's something worth killing over, the fact that, like, well, you look white, but you're not actually white. So that again, looking at the context of it, that's quite a... It's a bit unsavory, but it's not too dissimilar from the way that if you look at, say, you know, the whodunits of, like, the 20s, 30s, 40s, it's, you know, I don't think any of them's to that extreme, but they do have that kind of uncomfortable racial dynamic in there, which is like, my God, you know, someone isn't really white. Clearly they're suspicious. Clearly there's some kind of dark secret or some kind of unworthiness and that sort of thing, which... plus the fact that they then took the effeminate character and made them the killer, and I was just a bit like, okay. You can tell okay, this well, is them. Yeah.
Let me interrupt you for a second okay, here, Chris, and let me read you something here as well, because this is from Alfred Hitchcock, The Complete Films by Paul Duncan. Let me read you this one paragraph here. So, the story seems quite conventional. An actress is convicted of murder and sentenced to hang, but one of the jurors, Sir John Marinier, tries to prove her innocence by investigating the acting troupe. But Hitchcock adds some interesting touches about gender roles. There are women and male roles. We've got the female barrister, and the jury women are experts on psychology. Mm-hmm. And we have men in female roles. Handel Fane does a trapeze act in drag. and there's great emphasis on people changing clothes and identities.
Yeah.
And although Fane is revealed to have killed so that he is not revealed as a half-caste, his effeminate nature suggests that his real reason was to protect his homosexual identity. Yeah. So, that's, like, I read about the half-caste as biracial after the fact.
Yeah.
And so, watching the movie, I was interpreting that half-caste meant gay.
Oh, right, yeah.
While I was watching it. So, I, you know, so, because I'd never heard that term before.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, what do you think about that?
I mean, looking on it, and I've only seen it recently, I completely get that. And you do have someone who, when you see the performance, is very kind of consciously, you know, effeminate, or, you know, in modern day, kind of like, you know, is coded as, you know, a queer person or that sort of thing. Someone who doesn't fit into kind of like, you know, he's not like, you know, Sir John, or he's not like, Ted? Yeah, the other guy in the thing. He's not coded as like that. And so he is kind of distinctly other, and so it's like in the final sequence where, you know, they are convinced it's him, and he, you know, they end up going to the circus performer, and he kind of, from behind, because he ends up scaling a ladder and he's going to, you know, go perform as a trapeze artist, he sort of sheds his femininity, and he does look very feminine from a distance, because it's that kind of female impersonation thing. And it kind of becomes like androgynous, but not in a masculine way. It just looks like a blend, and it's just, I can see why they would see that as the other. I mean, it reminds me a lot, and it's not a Hitchcock film, but it's a very good whodunit film noir, and that's Laura in 1944, which is a woman is killed and blah blah blah, that sort of thing, and it ends up being an effeminate character who is coded as being gay, and is hinted at being gay throughout the whole of the, you know, the film and all that sort of thing. And then because of the Hays Code, they then switched it around and were like, oh no, well, you can't actually have him be openly gay. So you've got to, you know, when it's revealed he's the killer, you've got to change the reason. It turns out, oh no, he was effeminate, but he was in love with her all along, and that's why he, you know, he killed her. And it's just, it's that kind of stuff that, particularly, you know, I will be open and honest, my perspective as a gay dude kind of comes across and kind of going, oh yeah, no, that's not great. And we see it a lot kind of recur. So, you know, we've already mentioned the fact of, you know, the innocent person, you know, unjustly accused. You know, you've got Eugen Innocent, you've got Dialing for Murder, you've got, you know, all these sort of things. You've also got a theme recurring throughout Hitchcock, which is this kind of rejection of the, I suppose, the other, of the weird. So, not just here, but if you look at, say, Rope, where, you know, the two killers are implied to be in kind of like a homosexual relationship. In Frenzy, because I'd rewatched Frenzy really recently, you've got the killer who is set up then to have these weird sexual, you know, proclivities. You know, I was watching an interview about Hitchcock just before on my lunch break at work today, and it was a woman, I think it's from 60s or 70s. And she was talking about, okay, so you deal a lot with kind of like weird psychosexual stuff. And he's like, well, no, I don't. But she was pointing out, well, look at Psycho, look at, you know, Frenzy, look at all that sort of thing. So I think that's something that does recur. And it's kind of, it starts off here, really.
Mm-hmm. Tom, what do you think of the film and some of the stuff we've been talking about here?
Well, I was surprised the mention when Chris brought up a few minutes ago the idea of the biracial. That totally escaped me. I didn't even hear about that. And well, what I was reading,
he did say something when she mentioned that secret in the jail cell. Sir John does mention something about, like, dirty blood or something like that. Mm. I can't remember. Like, going back, I'm thinking mud blood, but I know that that's from Harry Potter.
Yeah.
Right? So, he said something along those lines. So, that was my indication at that time, but I still got that other impression. So, but yeah, we've never heard that term before.
In the Truffaut-Hitchcock interview book, Truffaut mentions, he says, getting back to the film Murder, which is in essence a thinly disguised story about homosexuality, in the final scene at the circus, the murderer is shown as a transvestite as he confesses to that he killed the victim because she was about to tell his fiancée all about him. And that's given as the reason that he commits suicide. And that's Truffaut talking directly to Hitchcock. And I get the impression that that was the storyline, but like we were saying, with all the censorship, they had to really bury it.
Yeah.
And maybe the biracial thing was brought up as an alternate definition, an alternate meaning, like as a decoy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very possible.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love the trapeze scene was amazing.
Oh,
like
the
suspense at the end there when he climbs that rope and you're looking at him going, what's he going to do? And when he starts swinging on the rope, you're thinking, oh, is he going to drop down and commit suicide? Like, is something going to happen that he's going to die? And then he lands back on his platform and you're thinking, oh, he didn't commit suicide.
Yeah.
And then he starts pulling up that single strand of rope and tying a noose. And it's very dramatic. And imagine these 100 people in that circus tent watching him hang himself, and it's just a very horrific scene, very graphically presented, and the reaction of the audience, they go crazy and people are storming out of the circus tent. Like, it was a very, very dramatic ending, very powerful.
Well, I thought he was going to fall, like pass out, because he started to look like he was dizzy or whatever. So I started to think he was going to fall, and then when he started to pull up that rope, honestly, I was like, oh my goodness, is he really going to do this? And that, for how long that rope was, that neck definitely snapped. Like, that was an instant death.
Yeah.
But the cutting and the way the camera was when he was swinging, you know, on the trapeze, and it was following him. Like, I don't even know how they did that. Like, that was amazing.
Well, the camera work in the film was very innovative and very progressive, considering, again, that this was very early in the very early days of film production. There was a lot of camera movement, like when early in the film, when the women are sitting in the house and the camera trucks left and right from room to room. That was very innovative.
There was no cuts for 3 minutes in that scene. Like, this is his third sound film where sound cameras were like bulky and heavy. And he's got this thing moving from room to room. Like, this is laying the groundwork for what he does in films like Rope.
Yeah.
Right. Like,
That's what I was thinking. Such joy to see this in this film. It was amazing. That scene was so awesome.
And in the jury room, when the jurors are sitting around a circular table, the camera goes back and forth and back and forth from character to character. And that's, you know, we're used to blocked off, immobilized shots in films of the era, and the camera work typically isn't very entertaining. But he did a lot of very innovative stuff with the camera in this film.
Mm-hmm. Like, this is clearly inspiration for directors like David Fincher. Like, Panic Room has got... I used to use it as an audio demo when I sold televisions and stuff, where there's this really long scene where the camera starts off on a character on a bed, it goes back, and then moves down a staircase, goes to a keyhole, comes out the keyhole, goes through a coffee maker. Like, you know, like, these types of scenes are definitely, you could tell, Hitchcock inspired many, many filmmakers with this film and the type of work that he did. I was blown away by that scene. Like, it's not, they're just talking, and how the woman was sitting, and then every time the one woman was getting tea, she would walk, and then the other person would get up and come and like off screen, and then she would sit down again, and then the one woman would move and she would have to get up and move along. Like, it was wonderful. It was absolutely wonderful.
And there was an innovation, there was a claim to fame for this film. We talked about it briefly earlier. It was the first example of interior monologue in British cinema. In the scene where he's shaving at the mirror, we hear his internal dialogue as he is talking to himself in the mirror, and all the everything else he mentioned about having to have a 30-piece orchestra in the studio to pull off the audio of the radio playing in the background. So Hitchcock is already flexing his creative muscle. He's being innovative. He's being he's entertaining us as best as he can with the film.
I really, really enjoyed this movie. Like, Like, I really want to watch it again because I watched the English one and then I've watched most of the German one. But I think now that I've processed the whole story, I think I want to go back and watch this again. Like, this might be my favorite Hitchcock so far that we've covered. Like, I really, really enjoyed this movie. And one of the scenes that I really liked was the jury scene. You know, and the way that they were talking and, you know, the tension that was created when we were just looking down at the guilty or not guilty pieces of paper, you know, and it was really kind of funny because the guy would frequently out of 10 pieces of paper, he was putting them in the wrong pile, you know, and then he'd move it. I'm like, oh, he put that in the, oh, there he moved it. You know, oh, he put that in the, oh, there he moved it. Because he kept putting the guilty or not guilty in the wrong pile. But even that scene was very stage oriented when they were questioning Sir John about, what do you got to say about that, Sir John? And the next time they did that line, two people, what do you got to say about that, Sir John? And the next time was three people, what do you got to say about that, Sir John? Until everybody was saying it as they were questioning him. You know, right. It was really well done. And there was even a lot of rapid cutting and a lot of rapid editing in that when they were questioning him about what was going on in the trial.
In the jury room scene, the cigarette lighting and the cigar lighting was all, you're just like, light the cigarette already, you know, like, we know you're, you know, it was all very done for a reason, and the characters are very rich and entertaining, for sure.
And the one of the coolest things in the movie was in that, when they were announcing the guilty sentence, and he kept the camera in the jury room, so we're not even seeing what's going on in the courtroom. We could just hear it. And there's that guy cleaning, and he steals that cigar that was left behind and just starts smoking this cigar. Like, we're left in a room with a cleaner smoking somebody else's cigar, and it's amazing. We don't hear what's going on. We don't see what's going on in the court as the guilty verdict is passed. We just hear it. Wow.
And, okay, here's a game changer for you. Again, preparing for the episode, reading from Peter Aykroyd's book, Alfred Hitchcock. Very creative title for the book. Anyway, he says that in the closing scene, it's revealed that the whole story is being played as a drama on the London stage.
Mm. Did that occur to you?
Yeah.
Like in the scene at the end where they kiss on stage and it pulls back to show the audience?
I didn't interpret it that way.
A dream sequence bubble bursting? Like it just didn't... I never caught that at all.
I thought it was just like a story within a story. Because it starts off, kind of, once they've identified it, it's the, you know, the guy who committed the murder, that it's... Because it sets up the idea of like, oh, this play and all that sort of thing. And then at the very end, when he hangs himself, you then have the confession, but it's all done in the context of a play.
Mm-hmm.
So he reads the notes and he's like, oh yes, two women standing there, you know, one of them falls to the ground, dazed, the guy doesn't check, that sort of thing. And then at the end, I thought, is it basically hinting that Sir John and Nora end up together? Because if it's like a retelling, is it like Sir John playing Sir John and Nora playing Nora and that's how it works? Or is the whole thing like a slight fabrication? Because I don't think that, like, it's basically saying, oh no, the whole film was a play and, you know, it was all fake and everything. I think what they're saying is they've taken potentially that play and maybe, you know, exaggerated it or maybe done this or maybe done that and have turned it into something else. So I don't know.
See, how I interpreted the ending is, like Sir John, there's a couple implausible elements in this, okay? So, I don't remember the woman's name. I'm sorry, I'm really bad with names. Yeah. But I know she's Mary in the German version because the movie's called Mary. So I'm just going to call her
Nora.
Is it Nora? Okay.
Nora.
So Nora is the person who's on trial, and Sir John has been contracted to be in the jury. Now, it turns out that Sir John is a very famous stage actor, and he happened to get pulled onto this case, and Nora had applied for a job to work with him on stage previously, and he sent her out to go and get more practice. And so he feels guilty because Had he not sent her out to go get more practice and just hired her, she would never have been in this situation. So that's why he's like trying to fight for her defense. So we learn this, and she's basically fallen in love with him because as he's investigating, he goes into her room. She sees a picture of him there, right? So she's kept a picture of him in her room, even though, you know, they don't really know each other that well. So she's clearly just in love with him because of seeing him on stage. And so he's a very important stage actor of his time. And so how I interpret the end is he's got her off the hook. The case ends up being solved. He had brought this this transvestite actor he's falsely telling him, I want to hire you for a play. And he writes the scene of the murder to try and elicit a confession out of him. And by getting the confession, by getting her off the hook, my interpretation of the last scene is he has now hired her to be his lady, and this is showing the happy ending of them working together and her being in his employ on stage working together. That's how I
And it's, in the simplest note, it's a happy ending because she's out of jail, she's back on the stage, she's a free woman.
Yeah.
She's vindicated, she's no longer, you know, convicted of this murder she didn't commit.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very sentimental, like a romantic ending, right?
Yes. Which I'm okay with. It's okay to have happy endings once in a while.
Yeah. that's allowed.
Excellent. Well, do you guys have any final comments or anything that we haven't addressed yet that you guys want to talk about?
No, I just really enjoyed it. I think I'm going to have to do the same as you and just review it again and just kind of... Because I think the first time around, at least for me, it's kind of making notes and kind of going like, right, okay, so this is this, or this is about this and that sort of thing. And I didn't actually just watch and sit and watch it through just like a pure, like a cinema experience. So I think I am going to do that because I did really enjoy this one.
And, well, we were lucky enough to get video clip versions of the film that are complete and whole and entire. Like, this is, we're not that far from the era when we had lost films or films that were partially chopped up, or we don't know for sure if the edit we're watching was the edit that was in the theaters back in the day. So we're now in a period of Hitchcock's work where we can watch the real film the way it was really done, and we were lucky to get a very high quality version to view. And no, general consensus, I agree. It was a good film. I enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm. Tom, what would you rate it out of 5?
I'm going to rate this 3 beautifully handwritten words, guilty of being a good film, on little torn pieces of paper and stacked in front of the head juror. I found the handwriting beautiful.
A beautiful handwriting.
Beautiful handwriting.
Chris, what do you give this out of 5?
I am going to give this 4.5 trapeze ropes that end up not being used for their intended purpose.
Ooh, fancy. I really love this movie, and I've been having trouble. I couldn't come up with a funny rating, so I'll try and come up with something off the cuff here. But I really enjoyed this movie. I think this might be my favorite so far. So I got to give this one 5 out of 5 amazing long takes.
How about 5 out of 5 half-smoked cigars?
5 out of 5 half-smoked cigars that I can steal from somebody and smoke on my own.
Yeah, that's a horror film in itself.
Excellent, right on. Well, before we go, again, we just want to give a big shout-out and a thanks to our friend Jason Cullimore for the wonderful music he's created for our show. Thanks so much to Norman Lau for creating our wonderful new show art. And as always, we are part of the Fandom Podcast Network. You can find them on Twitter at FanPodNetwork and on Facebook. And don't forget to check out our good friends Annie and Catherine and their podcast, Good Evening and Alfred Hitchcock Presents Podcast, where they're going through all the episodes of that show. And with their show and our show, you get a near comprehensive look at the Grandmaster's work. Chris, where can people find you online when you're not stealing cigars from somebody?
Well, when I'm busy not, you know, stealing cigars, faking murderers, and, you know, disappearing in white furs, you can find me on Twitter at @higher_boy. I just talk about all kinds of different stuff. I also have a podcast which I accidentally alluded to about 40 minutes ago called North by Nerd West, which is me and my best mate, Emma Platt. We meet up whenever we can, catch up on nerdy stuff, talk about whatever. It's very funny. It's basically two best mates catching up. That is available on iTunes. Episode 12 came out a little while ago, about a week and a half ago. So please make sure you check that out. Yeah, and then I have been appearing on a podcast called Eccentric Earth, which is snapshots of unusual or interesting things from history. So far I've done a massacre, I've done the Mothman, I've done possibly the best football or soccer player I've ever heard of. So yeah, there's a wonderful variety of stuff, and it's all done by Amy Walker, so you can find that on iTunes as well.
Tom, where can people find you when you're not mulling over your guilt over accidentally sending somebody to hang?
Instagram, I am the Tom Caldwell. On Twitter, Tom Caldwell 3000. And one more quick reminder, like, anybody listening to the show, get hold of us, make comments, give us feedback. We love to have interaction with our listeners.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
And you can find me on Twitter at Brandon Metella, and you can find me over on the Trek FM network with a show called Warp 5, which is all about Star Trek Enterprise. Next time on Good Evening, we'll be covering the film The Skin Game. The Skin Game will be the next movie that we cover, which is the first of two films released in 1931. That's all we got for you now, so I guess all that's left to say is good evening.
Good evening.
Good evening.